Go Loud. Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Close Brothers Motor Finance, recognised on Trustpilot as best in class in Ireland, with fast, fair finance decisions made in minutes, sometimes seconds. Motor dealerships and brokers looking to become a partner? Get in touch at closemotorfinance.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Magnified, our podcast series of detailed interviews. And today what we've decided to do is bring in the Chief Executive of Dublin City Council, Richard Shakespeare, not to talk about himself, but just to talk about his job. Because so many of you live in Dublin, so many of you visit Dublin, and so many of you have criticisms and want the place to be better, to look better, to feel safer. So these are all the things that I bring up with Richard Shakespeare. And as to whether you want cycling lanes as well. This series of Magnified is brought to you by Close Brothers Motor Finance, recognised on Trustpilot as best in class in Ireland, with fast, fair finance decisions made in minutes, sometimes seconds. Motor dealerships and brokers looking to become a partner can reach out to the team at closemotorfinance.ie. So now, our conversation with the man responsible for running Dublin. This is Richard Shakespeare. Now, today from Magnified, we're joined by a man who is responsible for nearly 6,000 staff across 520 services and has a budget not far short of $1.5 billion a year to spend. The Chief Executive of Dublin City Council, Richard Shakespeare, thank you very much for joining us.
No problem at all. Delighted to be here, Matt.
Okay. That's an awful lot of responsibility on one man. And the reason I thought we'd actually talk to you is we talk to politicians in the media all the time. But we don't necessarily always talk to the people who are responsible for making and implementing the decisions. So tell us a little bit about the job of being Dublin City Council's Chief Executive.
Okay, so there's a lot going on, but I'm not an island. I have what they call executive powers. The elected members have reserve power. So we've 63 elected councillors who effectively I'm accountable to. And sort of the day-to-day operational stuff, I have four assistant chief executives, head of finance or chief financial officer and a law agent. And there are other city posts which sit in with that. But no 2 days are the same. I mean, it is actually, it's good fun. If I'm being brutally honest with you, it's not the type of job I think you can do if you're not enjoying it. And I've been lucky throughout my career that whatever role I've had, I've actually enjoyed it. But the complexity, and I suppose when I started out, and I'm in post now about a year, just over a year, and I was being interviewed for the job either side of the Dublin riot. But my whole thing was that if we can get the basics right, the simple things, like when you walk out your door, what do you want to see? You want to see clean street. You want to see cut grass. You want to see a pavement that you're not going to break an ankle on. You want the street lights to work. So if we can get those basic things right and be proactive in our approach, I think the bigger things, you know, the big capital stuff, which everybody's drawn to, everybody loves sort of the sexiness of a capital project, a big project. But you need to, I suppose, earn trust amongst the wider population. So that's what I'm trying to do. And that's why, like, I suppose, pulled out all the stops in terms of the central business district and in terms of recruitment. I mean, back in the day, I mean, long before I came into the city council, I'm in the city council 8 years, so I'm not a city council lifer.
Because you had been out in the suburbs.
Oh, I had been out in the leafy South Dublin suburbs, working in Dunleary Rathdown as everything from a park superintendent through to, you know, the administrative side of things. That's how I got sidetracked into this side of things, because if you'd have asked me 25 years ago, would I be sitting here in front of you as the chief executive of Dublin City Council, I probably would have laughed heavily in your face, to be honest with you. But so we had this focus, I wanted to have this focus on getting the city centre cleaner. Now, it's never going to be perfect. So we went out with a recruitment drive and we're looking for an additional 100 staff, because when you look back in pre-crash, there was 7,300 people employed by Dublin City Council, albeit we were in the domestic and commercial refuse collection and it was pre-Irish Water or Ishgairn as it is now. You might say so, but to get stuff done, you really need a resource, staff. To have staff, you need funding. And so trying to put all of those bits and pieces in.
There's loads of stuff even there that I want to pick up on. So the first thing I want to talk to you about is the Dublin riots. Yeah. Did they come as a surprise to you? Or was there ever a feeling that, you know, we've got a tinderbox here which could light up at some stage?
I suppose post-COVID, it just felt a little edgier. You know what I mean? That's just with the reduced footfall into the city because of the remote working piece. An awful lot of people are working a sort of a three in the office, two from home. But in general, the footfall, you know, just the working footfall as such is down about 25%. So you were seeing more, you might say, and I come in and out by bus predominantly, and I'd be walking up and down the quays. And you generally see more and of the type of behaviour that was possibly there, but you weren't really seeing as much of it.
Do you feel that walking through Dublin, and this is a complaint that many listeners to The Last Word would have made at the time of the Dublin riots and afterwards, and that they were saying that whether they were native Dubliners, or as in living in Dublin, or whether they were visitors to the city from other parts of the country, that they didn't feel safe, that they felt that they were constantly having to look over their shoulders. And I would have to say that's something I would have felt. I live in Dublin now at this stage for over 35 years. I love the city, but I would walk around the city quite a lot as well. I get public transport. And particularly when I was doing my last book, Who Really Owns Ireland, I would have walked all around Dublin city centre, up and down the side streets, looking at everything, looking at what was being done new, what was falling away. And the one thing that really struck me was a sense of dereliction around large parts of the city. And lack of cleanliness, for which I'm not necessarily going to blame the council. I think a lot of that is down to the behaviour of people who are responsible for creating this mess and expecting somebody else to clean up after them. But just a sense of walking up to Croke Park or walking around the Connell Street areas, that it just isn't as good as you want it to be.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose from my perspective, and I've said this before, I've never really felt unsafe. But you might say, when you know where you're walking to, and as in any capital city or in any large city, you know, there are places which are edgier than others. And you tend not to go, you know, when you have the experience of knowledge of your environment or age, you tend not to go where you know you might. It's not that it is there. And so from that side of things, my bellwether would be, I have four boys, okay, one is 17, but I've twin 27-year-olds and a 24-year-old. And predominantly the twins, who are 27, have never really sort of said they felt unsafe, you know, and they'd be in and out, as young lads are, they're in and out of town all the time. And so I suppose my lived experience would be a little similar to your own and a lot of other people. And it is that perception piece. It might not be, but the perception has a habit of becoming reality. And if you lose footfall, You know, there's always, as you say, safety in a crowd. So the more people that are in town and in the city centre, the safer it naturally be, because you've got the passive surveillance piece. And whilst we don't, as a city council, have direct responsibility for safety, but we have a responsibility in how the city centre and the city is presented. And so, as I said to you earlier, that the loss in staff, something had to happen. The local government sector, between sort of 2008, 9, 10, as a whole throughout the country, there was, at the step before the crash, there was about 34,500 people working in the local government sector. After the crash, there was about 26,000. That's a seismic drop. And when you listed out the services that we provide, something suffers. You know what I mean? And so you might say, that's why my focus, now I'm lucky, you know, in that staff numbers are growing.
But if you had the budget, would you have lots more people out cleaning the streets? Taking on the basis that people are going to litter, because we just seem to have that culture in this country where people think they can just throw stuff away. Would you have more people out? Would you change the litter collection system? Because I see today, and it's interesting, that you're now going to be using CCTV to try and catch people who are actually dumping plastic bags on the side of the street, just leaving them there for somebody else to collect. And if you had the budget, would you put an awful lot more into street cleaning, for example?
Well, there's a lot of other things that need to be done as well.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, so it's what you're trying to do is get a good mix of change in behaviour. Yet we're there, you know, I suppose, with our new machinery, because that was the other part of a lot of the machinery was had aged.
Yeah.
And the fleet hadn't been replaced. So we're moving to a greener side of things. But I think we'll hit a sweet spot now by the end of the first quarter in terms of the waste management staff. So we did a review, would have been in 2023, which identified, to you might say, the need for an additional 105 staff, not just in the city centre, but in the suburbs as well, because we've 31 towns and villages which don't necessarily get the level of service that they deserve, and we're trying to change that, and hence the improved fleet, but also the boots on the ground. And the other bit is that, you know, trying to engender a pride in your patch type of thing, you know, and to do it softly. I mean, we could, you know, the Litter Control Act, you know, places a responsibility on shop owners. I mean, when I was a student and I was working in bars and pubs, and, you know, what you used to do was you were sent outside at the end of the night and you cleaned up outside and then you cleaned up inside. But when I walk through the streets, and I'll get off the bus at different locations just to have a look, my staff hate it because I'll WhatsApp them with messages, photographs of dirty streets, and then we piloted something the year before last, when I was the interim chief executive, and it was the management team adopted a couple of streets, so they were walking down those streets at different times of the day and night.
You don't have weekend. A sweep.
Yeah, no. Yeah. But it was just to get a sense, because I think it's not just on the city engineer and his team and all of that crew. As a collective responsibility in terms of the senior leadership in Dublin City Council, you know, you really need to know what's going on in your city. It doesn't matter whether you're in charge of planning or whatever. But so there's a, there's more of a collaborative approach to it. But it's a multifaceted type of thing. You want people to have pride in their patch. We've moved and we've, you might say, lifted the derogation on the use of wheelie bins in 90 streets on the south side. It's coming to the north side. And, you know, but that's only 10% of the streets where bag presentation is acceptable. And we've noticed that, that there's been quite a an uptick in the cleanliness on the streets that we have. But we've worked with the waste management sector.
The reason I decided I'd like to interview you is because I love living in Dublin, but I suppose, like anyone, I think if you have pride in where you live, you know, you want it to look and feel better as a place, yep. right? And, you know, you give you examples. I remember saying this to people recently, but we had to drop one of the young fellas up to the airport at around 5 o'clock in the morning. And we drove down Camden Street. I mean, what a mess, right? Absolute and utter mess. Caused by people going out of the pubs and the restaurants and the rest of it and stuff, who seem to have no pride in the city in which they live. And I realise I'm sounding like an old fella now in relation to this. Yes. And it was good to see coming back at about 6:30 in the morning that there were teams of Dublin City Council people out there cleaning the place up, making the place respectable for the day again. But I suppose a lot of it comes down to people complain about, oh, but this isn't done for us, that isn't done. But what about people taking responsibility for themselves?
There is that piece around, you might say, there's a dependency culture can creep in.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have it with in certain areas, I suppose, with grass cutting and the verges. Grass cutting, you know. Where I'm living, out in the leafy South Dublin suburbs, where I've lived most of my life, you know, you cut the grass outside your house.
Yeah.
You know, full stop. In the city council, when we introduced that, there was some disquiet among some of the elected members. And it's always around the margins.
Are you talking about common green areas outside?
Well, no.
You're talking about the grass in your own garden?
Yes. Well, outside, you know, the grass verge outside.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And people have said, oh, that's not for us to do. That's for the council to do.
Yeah. So, but it is that whole piece that you might say, if you have, you know, if you're proud of where you live, you know, you'll go out and you'll do the cleanups with the neighbours and you'll do the bits and pieces. You'll do the little bit of scuffling or weeding along the curb. And, you know, you treat it like a bit of your own property nearly.
Okay, coming back to something else, you said earlier about the 3-day working in the office and 2-day working at home and how that's taken numbers out of Dublin City Centre. Now, I'm in Dublin City Centre every day, well, Monday to Friday, because Marconi House is here in Diggs Lane in the city centre. And so I tend to wander around the streets and stuff like that for my lunch or whatever and stuff. And it has struck me that certainly the numbers in the city centre in recent years have fallen as well as this level. And also in addition to that, what strikes me is if we didn't have all the tourists that we have, just how hollow would the city centre actually look?
I mean, that is, I'd have concerns. You know, you might say that a significant fall off in tourism would make it look a little thinner. And so there is a fine balance to be struck, because I suppose pre-COVID, it actually on occasions was quite uncomfortable to walk around the streets.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That just going about your daily business, whether it's going out for a sandwich or...
Too full.
You know, yeah. You know what I mean? And that's why I suppose, you know, how do you move people around the city?
Oh, get into transport.
Figured that. I just thought I'd give you the opportunity there, Matt. But, you know, so from that side of things, it is, and the other bit there is I look at things as well, you know, from a commercial rate base. So if, you know, we're starting to convert all these these vacant office blocks, and an awful lot of them aren't suitable to be converted in the adaptive reuse bit.
Into apartments.
I lose a commercial rate base, which, you know, when you look at how local government is funded, you know, commercial rates is a significant element of it, less so the property tax. And we're very heavily reliant on government funding. So it does feed all into, you know, well, how much control do the executive and the elected members of Dublin City Council actually have?
Okay, and we'll get back to transport. But it's car commercial rates actually inherently unfair on businesses? And I'll explain this one to you and why I feel this way. Because I remember when many years ago when I was editor of the Sunday Tribune and we had premises back in Baggot Street.
Yeah.
And I remember the rates bill used to come in every year. And despite the fact that I was editor, I used to have to deal with all these things as well. And I always remember thinking that it was almost inherently unfair. I used to say, I don't mind about paying a higher rate of corporation tax because at least we'd be making profits to pay the corporation tax on. But we're losing money and yet we still have to pay this bill, which is a form of tax based on the premises that we're in, which we need to have, or else we could have gone off somewhere else, maybe cheaper to do it. Are commercial rates a fair levy to place on businesses?
That's an unfair question, Matt, to ask it, you know, for someone who's reliant.
Can you understand why I ask?
Oh, I can indeed. And it is, it's a necessary cost of doing business, okay? Because for your people to get to work, they need roads, they need footpaths, you know, for, you might say, places to recreate in the city, Merrion Square Park. You've got all of these things, the greening, the healthy bit, all of that type of stuff benefits the business community to, you know, probably a reasonable percent. And that's why you figure out the commercial rates is about probably just shy of a third of the overall income into the city council. So when you look at what it costs to run...
The other two-thirds coming from the state, is it?
You'd have, a lot of coming from that. And then you've goods and services, you've car parking, you've, you know, revenue from concerts in St. Anne's Park and things like that. So, you know what I mean? But it is, you might say, it is a way of doing it. And you've about 100 million comes in the local property tax. So, you know, and that's local services paid for by local citizens, and that's around the country. But I think what it is that the fact that most ratepayers, you know, in terms of, you might say, the electoral system, wouldn't necessarily have the same level of influence that the general population would have, because a lot of the people who are, say, working in the city centre are coming from Wicklow, Dunleary, Rathdown, South Dublin, Fingal. You know what I mean? So they're coming from a wider geographic area. I can understand the concern. It's a, you know, but the funding is necessary to help the city function and to, you know. And it is the stuff, a lot of stuff that you don't necessarily see.
Would it be better for Dublin City if people were back working in the office 5 days a week instead of three? Now, I know there would be traffic management issues in relation to that, but would it be better for the health of the city if people were in every day, filling the shops, filling the cafes, staying for something to eat or drink after work, going to a show, those sort of things?
From a personal perspective, yes. You know, I get the remote working and people got used to, a life-work balance, that they were multitasking or they were closer to collecting, able to spend more time with the kids as opposed to commuting and stuff like that. So I get it. There was always a bit of remote working because not everybody was working in the city, you know, that was employed by somebody. You look at the big law firms or the big four or whatever. But when I look at some of my staff, and I've got firefighters, can't put out a fire working from home. You know, you've got all those essential workers, guards, nurses, you know, in terms of the ability to work from home. And so there's a bit of a lack of equity there. I can't cut grass sitting in my, you know, can't fix a pothole.
When everyone talks about remote working, it's for the sort you might call the professional classes. It's for people who are not doing manual or physical labour.
Yeah, so there's an equity piece there.
It's discrimination there almost.
I don't know whether it is, but I mean, it is there's a lack of equity. You know what I mean? And that sometimes when people are out beating their chests about the right to work from home, there are people who can't physically do their work from home.
And would you worry then as well about retailing? I mean, one of the big things in a city is shops.
Yeah.
And as more and more people look to buy online rather than going into shops, where is that going to leave Dublin City
Centre? I read it.
And also what you could describe as the towns and villages within Dublin.
But what I look at, you know, I mean, read a piece there, I think it was in the Business Post, I think Donald MacDonald from Arnott's and Brown Thomas. Their actual physical retail sales are up 5% for 2024. Their online sales were up 20%. And I think, you know, it is that experience. I think the experience, you know, you need a reason, you know, for the people who might be reluctant, or you need a reason for people to come into the city centre. That is a unique experience that you can have, the hustle and bustle. It's a bit like, you know, everybody loves the
market. Being with other people.
Yeah, but, it's a joyless exercise sitting there on your phone or laptop, you know, ordering something from Jeff Bezos or whatever. And, you know, yeah, it's sort of the... what I like about the retail experience, it's sort of, you know, there's instant gratification. You don't have to wait, you know, and be reliant on DHL or on Post or whoever. But whether that says more about me now or not, I don't know.
I was just thinking here that if anyone who might be younger listening to these two old dinosaurs giving out about the way things should be and the way they're done now. I mean, I have kids much the similar age to yours as well, and I'm always giving out to them about going online to buy and stuff. But my argument to them is like, well, what are the city that you live in, what's it going to be like if it keeps getting all of the commerce, keeps getting sucked out of it?
Yeah, and I mean... It is, but that's why I say, like, the people need to understand, I suppose, the difference and of the experience. And, you know, it's...
Well, are there enough good experiences in Dublin, right? I mean, I'm fascinated by, I'm interested, I think, and it's been a great development, things like bringing American football into Dublin.
Yep.
Things like the college's American football, and now hopefully we'll have NFL coming this year to Croke Park in September. You're not going to say anything at this stage. That's what we're expecting anyway. And I'd love if the GAA moved the All-Ireland Finals back to September as well.
Yeah, no, I'd be there with you, you know.
But it doesn't look like that's actually going to happen. But we have all of these sports events, which is great for people who can get tickets. But there also is a sense of buzz around the city when you have big games on, and it benefits bars and restaurants and everything, and gets people in a good mood communally together, and all the concerts and stuff and go on. But yet, is there enough actually happening in Dublin city centre to attract people into it?
Probably not, you know. And, you know, that's why it's great to see the ambassador
at the top of O'Connell Street
now being activated with sort of comedy, and you know, so they that's been more active. You know, we need the redevelopment of the GPO, for argument's sake, and that needs to have some cultural piece there. But I think part of the problem, you know, is that the cultural institutions need to be open longer. Not everything can revolve around a pint and, you know, all of this type of stuff. I mean, and I, you know, I'd probably get shot now, you know, but I was a proponent of the Whitewater thing, purely and simply to get
Whitewater
something.
Whitewater Rafting Centre, which would have cost about 20 million quid, would it?
Well, yeah. But I mean, you talk about experiences.
Yeah.
And now I'm meeting the people who are proposing the Lido.
Yeah,
for the same space. And so we'll see how that comes
out.
The Lido, so George's Dock was where the Whitewater was supposed to go. And now you know, there was a push against that it was commercializing a space, you know, but that we've no outdoor swimming facilities in the city, other than people, you know, when it gets to jumping into the Liffey or into one of the canals or whatever, and not exactly the safest pursuit to be engaged in. So we'll have a look at that. But something that isn't, you know, all about, like, I like a jar, you know, and I like the crack you can have after a couple, because, you know, the vocal cords get looser and you can have a good old gossip, you can have a chin wag, whatever. But there needs to be something. If you take it that your family coming in, there's only so many, you know, if you've kids who are sort of 12, 14, 16 years of age, there's only so many museums or galleries that they're going to want to be interested in. So there needs to be, you know, other experiences that don't revolve around a pint.
Yeah, but also there are some experiences, and I can't get over it. When I moved to Dublin from Cork in the late 1980s, I mean, my 1980s and 1990s were spent in our nightclubs. I mean, even, God help us, Leeson Street and all the illegal drinking dens and everything.
I was one of those soldiers as well.
Absolutely, given that we're of a similar age. Hey. And Lily's Bordello and Reynard's and the rest of it.
Well, I wouldn't have been the upmarket.
But when I think of it now, I mean, there's so little for our 20-somethings to enjoy. I mean, a nighttime czar has been appointed, but we have few nightclubs and everything.
In fairness now, I think, you know, that's a very good move, and I'll give full credit now to outgoing Minister Catherine Martin for really pushing that. And so we're one of, I think, 6 pilots in the city, and Ray O'Donoghue is the nighttime economy advisor. And, you know, he's trying to do bits to activate spaces that wouldn't necessarily traditionally have been used for anything in particular, but just to get an energy, because that type of energy around the nighttime economy is really important. That there needs to be something for everybody in the audience as such. But again, you know, all of that. So I mean, when you look at it, back in the day, it was, you know, Thursday night. You know, when you were in college. And
well, the students still go out on the night and they hit Camden Street and places like that.
But you might say they're drinking less.
Yeah.
Okay, so an economy based on alcohol consumption isn't necessarily a good thing. Now, it happens, so we need to, you know, you need to cater for it. But you might say, so it is one of those conundrums as to how to activate.
It's because it strikes me, not only is it something that our younger people are missing out on, but okay, maybe they just don't want to have the sort of the lifestyle that we would have had in our 20s and the rest of it. But tourists coming here as well, younger tourists, I sometimes wonder, what do they think? Everything shuts up at around 11 o'clock.
Ah, well, you know, but then they drift down Camden Street, they go up to Harcourt Street, they go down into Temple Bar, and there's plenty of nightlife.
There's enough for them.
But there isn't sort of, you know, and there's smaller little venues with DJ sets going on and stuff like that. But if you look, and we've a very good website that we created and run on behalf of the 4 Dublin authorities, and it's dublin.ie, and it's sort of live, work and play in Dublin type of thing. And that is constantly updated with things to do. So a lot of the time, you know, people will come and do it, you know. But I mean, I think... one thing that I actually loved about the Florida State game last year against Georgia Tech was that ESPN came in and did game day from College Green. Bonker stuff. But great crack. You know what I mean? So I'd love to see something like that, you know, on a Sunday of an All-Ireland final or semi-final. You know, to really activate that space on a consistent basis, you know, because with the city centre transportation plan, I think a once in a generational opportunity to really activate that space. And when you look at it, we're not gifted as a city with places to commune. but reasonably large places to commune. And, you know, so trying to create and retrofit one of those. I mean, I'm just waiting for Dublin Bus to do their network redesign so we can actually get about and pilot that space.
Well, let's talk about transport. I'm actually just thinking College Green, and I think in the big night days out there, the Irish football team coming back from the World Cup 1990, Barack Obama coming to visit. But there are few and far between of the times that it's been used in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated and expensive space to pedestrianise.
Okay.
And, you know, so from that side of things, if we have it,
you have to stop the Lewis and things like that.
Well, no, you don't, because the Lewis is right down at the Trinity end, but you've got from there up to South Great George's Street that you can use. But just, it's sometimes fascinating. This might be my landscape, horticulture, architecture brain, but it's great to see, go out and just leave the space, see how people use it before you go in and over-design something for them. Let's see how they interact with a space. I mean, I used to love, you might say, you know, when you're doing design jobs back in the day, you know, 20-odd years ago, 25 years ago nearly at this stage, but you'd sit in a space and just see an empty field or in a park, and you'd see how are people actually using this? Does it need an intervention? What type of intervention to try to support that use as opposed to, you know, having the monopoly on the right way of doing something just because I'm a design professional, you know?
Just before we come back to the transport, which I do want to talk about, but what about living over the shop in Dublin City Centre?
Yeah.
I mean, you said earlier that a lot of commercial premises or office blocks can't be converted into apartments, but surely throughout the city, in around this area where we are in Diggs Lane, down into O'Connell Street area in particular, surely something can be done to persuade the owners of these properties to convert them into flats and apartments. And I know that there's all these problems in relation to fire regulations, which is often cited. But Jesus, other cities manage it. Look at Paris. Everyone lives over the shop in Paris.
But I would, you know, and yeah, I have a couple of pals who live in Paris, visited them, and, you know, you're thinking, you know, living over a bakery or something like
You'd never get a fire cert for it in Dublin, would you?
No. And I doubt if you get a fire cert for it in Paris, but they're there so long. You know what I mean? And I think what you had was previously where you had the owner-occupied shops and in towns and villages and cities throughout the country. So you lived over the shop.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the fact that it was one unit, it didn't have to be hermetically sealed as such from a fire prevention perspective. But I do think one of the issues is, and we've had this Living City initiative for a number of years where you get a tax break and things like this. And an awful lot of people don't want to go down the tax break type of, you know, route. You know, they'd rather stay away from the revenue commissioners, you know. But I do think if there are other supports, and when you look at the programme for government, they are talking about trying to, how do you energise that space? Because there's a lack of viability. And, you know, you can't expect the shop owner to plough money in if there's not going to be a return on his investment. And that's the real challenge, is how do you make it commercially viable for the owner of the shop to convert above? Because there's a lot of work to get, you know, there is an engineering solution to the, you might say, the fire regs and the building control regs, but they're expensive solutions, which then you question over
the financial viability.
The financial viability.
And return on the rent.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about transport a little bit. Do you cycle?
Infrequently.
Okay. Would you feel safe cycling in Dublin?
In certain areas, yes. In others, no. I tend to walk. I choose to walk and get the bus. I find that I see more. It's not transactional or functional for me. I see more
by walking.
By walking,
I understand that.
But it's not my bag, and I would never have been, you know, an overly confident cyclist anyway. You know, I did crash into a parked car on the way home from college on one occasion, which kind of put me off the bike for a while.
Yeah, but had you been drinking?
Yeah, I couldn't. That's a ecumenical matter. But, you know, so there are areas, and I'm not fond of the plastic ones. I don't believe they afford much protection. They give a bit of separation.
For the cyclist, yeah. Absolutely.
And we need to come up with a more permanent solution. And I think when you look at the Clontarf City Centre cycle route, I think that's a really good success story, albeit painful to deliver over sort of 2 years for anybody living on the north side of the city trying to commute in. But that, and then you've got the, you know, the Dodder Greenway, you've got the canals, you know, so where you're off road, and I mean, it is, and this comes down to the thing about
this is the interesting thing, whereas off-road it works for me, because does the city or do Dubliners want cycle lanes on their roads?
Well, you'll have every faction will have a different opinion. And, you know, when it was a case, if you remember there last August, somebody had to make a decision about whether we would implement the traffic changes on the quays. And to say that I was threatened by all sides, you know, injunctions from the car park owners, some of the retailers, the cycling lobby, my own councillors, and all pulling and pushing you in different directions. But, you know, the road space is contended. So you need, if we want, you might say, cycling, and we want that whole active transport and active travel piece, we need to make provisions. Something has to sacrifice. And you can say, oh, well, that'd be fine if we had a public, you know, a functioning bus system and all of the bits and pieces. Well, I can tell you that my commute on a bus on a 145 reduced by 25 minutes. And that's just on the quays. I used to get the bus outside the forecourts, a 145, down the quays, take you 20, 25 minutes before you across O'Connell Bridge. And likewise, coming in through Pier Street. So I got to a stage where, okay, it was healthier. I was getting off the bus then in Dawson Street or Leeson Street and walking in a different route. Now, that's fine on a nice day. But when it's lashing rain, not exactly the most comfortable bit. But so the bus times have really improved on the quays. And that's why I'm really keen to get, you know, the infrastructure is now in place to take the buses out of College Green. And it'll mean that, you might say, because we built a contraflow bus lane up Wine Tavern Street there at Christchurch for the buses to be able to go out to the west side of the city. But it is always going to be, oh, well, then it's, you know, you have to wait for the Metrolink and all of this. No,
it's a bit like chicken and egg, isn't it?
Oh, it is, yeah. But I mean, I suppose what you're really talking about, Matt, is that you either want to, you either respect, and everybody is, you know, beating their chest and shouting loud and proud about climate change and climate action. It's a simple little one. Uncomfortable in terms of people's comfort and driving into town, but the road space is contended, and the fewer cars and things like that. I mean, if you look at coming in, go down Leeson Street, you know, you're coming to the bottom of Leeson Street and you've got these little shark fins for the cyclists. Now, and then, of course, invariably some delivery driver will have seen the necessity to park up there. And then the cyclist has to come out of there and down.
Which is very dangerous, and then come back into the traffic.
Yeah. So
that happens in the Clontarf route a lot, apparently.
So there are certain pinch points there. But I do believe that it is, we do need to make, you know, the off-road and to do actual separation.
Yeah, but is it going to become an awful lot more contentious? And this isn't just your responsibility, the National Transport Authority involved in this. When the bus gates finally start going in the sort of the inner suburbs, shall we say, around Dublin?
Well, I suppose what you have is you've got the whole bus connects project. And, you know, that's still a few jumps away from being, I mean, 10 of the 12 routes have, you know, been through the planning and the courts. So you might say you need to look at it in its totality. Everybody tends to look at it, you know, oh, this is, you know, their little, how am I going to be impacted, as opposed to looking at the common good? And that'd be one of the issues there, that sometimes you just need to put the common good to the forefront of your mind, and less so the self-interest, which can be hard. But, you know, if we don't make these changes, and that's everything from wind and solar and transport and all of that, you know, we won't be having a debate in 50 years' time, because God knows what will have happened. You know what I mean? So I think that there needs to be greater understanding. I think a lot of the time our communications aren't what they should be, and that the messages aren't clear enough, consistent enough. And that's on us. And that's on us as the city councils and the National Transport Authority. But I do believe that a well-informed public are actually quite accepting.
Yeah, I don't want to go all conspiracy theorist in this, because if I mention 15-minute cities, that's what really the far right at the moment go absolutely crazy about. But is this the ambition that a lot of people running cities have, that with efficient public transport in place, you would be able to use public transport or walk or cycle to most of the things that you want to be able to do within 15 minutes or so?
I mean, long before Mayor Hidalgo sort of coined this 15-minute city, it was a reality. You know, you just it was packaging something that was there. And there are an awful lot of areas in the city, and throughout the, you know, particularly Dublin City, where it is, everything is, you know, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the school, the primary health centre, all of these things are close enough by. And I mean, I remember when I was out in Dunleary Rathdown, and I was looking at, you know, of course, self-interest, with playgrounds. And we developed a play strategy back in 2000. And my twins were three. But it was, the base was that nobody should be more than a 15-minute walk from a playground. Hmm. You know, so we looked at where our playgrounds were, and then we just drew the circles, you know, and put a playground in where there were gaps. And then, okay, your bigger playgrounds, you know, 10-minute drive. You know what I mean? So it was... but just so as if you're pushing a pram or a buggy, that, you know, you can get somewhere, and there's somewhere different or whatever. So I think, you know, this thing of, you might say, the 15-minute city, you know, and all conspiracy theories, I think it's actually to a large part, I'm not going to say now it's all that, but to a large part it's there.
But it's also common sense, isn't it? I mean, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
You'll have to go to places that are beyond your 15 minutes if you want to go to a game in Croke Park or the Aviva,
yeah,
or whatever.
But the day-to-day stuff.
But the day-to-day stuff, yeah, yeah. Your schools, your doctors. And they,
yeah.
Yeah. It's like making a city a whole series of maybe urban villages.
Well, it is, you know, Dublin is, you know, outside the city centre, 31 towns and villages. And it is that sort of network of neighbourhoods. And for the most part, you can get all of the things that you need for your day-to-day life, your kids, your creches, whatever.
I'm going to finish by asking you a question, sort of prompted by a lot of the comments we get into the last word, whenever we're debating national spending, and this belief that Dublin gets everything, that all the money is invested, the jobs are all moved towards Dublin when you have foreign investment coming in, or when the big projects like National Children's Hospital is in Dublin City Centre, National Maternity Hospital is going to be, all the things are making Dublin bigger all the time rather than actually spreading stuff out to the regions. Dublin Airport's another example. Lots of people say, well, why is there all the fuss about making Dublin Airport bigger when instead you could be diverting people to Shannon or to Cork,
yeah, yeah,
or to Knock or to Waterford or whatever. So what do you think of this contention that Dublin demands and gets everything?
I haven't really demanded a whole lot in my time, Matt, but I think what you have is that you look at the property tax, okay, and you talk about funding, talk about just the money. So pre-2014, pre the property tax, you know, we used to get a lot of funding, grant aid for different, be it regional, local roads, you know, a whole range of other areas that we were funded by the state. Okay. And those grant pots then after 2014, we weren't allowed to use those grant pots. Okay. So we're self-funded for those now. But those grant pots have increased over time. Where has the money gone? It's been distributed. They've got rid of the 20% top slicing, but the urban areas have, you might say, there's been a rebalancing in terms of state funding and access to state funding that's there. But when you look at, and it's a case of, you know, the infrastructure investment that is needed to keep a city like this running, growing, you know, and is it the right thing to do? Well, you know, 52 to 54%, I think it is, of GDP is North Wicklow, Louth, Meath, Dublin, the three Dublin local authorities. And again, it's that concentration of stuff. And that, like, the tourists, in terms of the transport, they want you, you know, if the tourist wants to come to Dublin, it's a bit like, you know, capital will go where it makes the most return for the people who own the capital. You know, from a financial perspective.
So, Richard, just to finish, if there were three things you could get from Dublin, if you had a magic wand and you had no budgetary constraints, what would they be?
It would be unfettered access to the capital markets. I think we need to be self-sufficient. I think we were too closely tethered to the centre. You know, so if you want to govern effectively, you need the ability to tax and raise money and do all of those things. So that'd be it, you know, because I think we need that. There's a bit of self-sufficiency, and I am a fan of a directly elected mayor, even though
it's what a job.
Correct. It would change my role. But people, I'm appointed. I'm not elected. So that'd be the other bit there. But it needs to be appropriately empowered, and, you know, not to have bits of the HSE carved off from bits of the Department of Education, but the stuff that we're good at.
But that's almost like setting up a city state within the country, that Dublin becomes its own independent region.
Well, look at Austria. Look at Vienna. Everybody cites the Vienna housing model. It's a city state. I'm not advocating for it, but it's not unheard of. But
funny enough, if we were, and this is really thinking a little bit sideways, but if we were ever to move towards a United Ireland, it could be that the United Ireland would become a sort of the various provinces and cities becoming their own almost individual states within an overall United Ireland might be the safest way of actually getting everyone to buy in.
Yeah, I have to confess, Matt, I'd never looked at it that way. But, you know, so I do think that there are, you know, there's a need to enhance the local democracy, because they need to, you know, I say I'm accountable to 63 elected members who in turn are accountable to the voter. You know, I don't have, you know, so I can make, you know, you might say decisions that are potentially unpopular. But the nature of a democracy is that, you know, the people who choose to represent their communities should have a greater say in how those communities continue to develop.
I asked you for three, you only gave me one.
I gave you one, which was unfettered access. Yeah. Two, directly elected mayor.
Right.
And three, if I could wave a magic wand, it would be to, you know, really go after the over-the-shop living, because I think, and the you know, to get rid of some of the vacant sites, you know, get that old Carlton site done and dusted, because that's
it's only there 40 years vacant.
You know, and I mean, Jesus. I mean, I remember being in the cinema there, like, you know, Jesus. And that's not today or yesterday, but
it's over 40 years the bloody site has been
vacant. I know, yeah. And but
with a big eyesore in the middle of our biggest street in the country, which should be the absolute centre for everything, for people coming into the country and for people from all over around the country. And we have this big bloody eyesore at the back.
Matt, you're not getting any disagreement from
this
side
of the table. I'm just having a little rant myself to finish out, like, you know. All right, listen, Richard, thank you for talking, explaining a bit more about making Dublin a better place, which I think for everybody, not just in Dublin, but for Ireland, that's what we should want, isn't it?
Yeah, no, and thanks for the opportunity. It's always good to vent these things.
Thank you very much.
Okay, cheers, Matt.
And that is with thanks to our series partners, Close Brothers Motor Finance. Rated excellent on Trustpilot, our customer service and portal Close Connect means we can say yes more often, approve finance applications in minutes and sometimes seconds. Looking to partner with us? Reach out to the Motor Finance people at Close Motor Finance. We hope you've enjoyed this latest episode of Magnified. Our thanks to Richard Shakespeare for coming in. And we have more great guests in the weeks to come. So hopefully you can join us then, or go back and catch up with any of those previously done that you may have missed. Until then, from me, Matt Cooper, thank you for joining us.
Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Close Brothers Motor Finance. With Close Connect, our technology means we can say yes more often. Approve finance applications in minutes and sometimes seconds. Partner with Close Brothers Motor Finance at closemotorfinance.ie.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.